2 years ago, I was in Cambodia with a few students. We had traveled to the capital city, Phnom Penh, for research we were conducting for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. On the third day of our trip, we drove through chaotic streets of the capital and arrived at a modern coffee house in the central part of town. We were led to a private room in the back of the coffee shop, where three women sat at a table waiting for us. They were each holding a baby. The summer before, the Cambodian police had arrested these women and charged them with human trafficking. Not for smuggling people, but for caring to term the babies they now held in front of us. They had been hired as surrogates for families in Australia and China, promised $10,000 to go through in vitro fertilization and give birth. The government arrested them and held them for the remaining term of their pregnancies, first in jail and then in a prison hospital, where they all gave birth. A judge offered them an option: either raise the babies as their own in Cambodia or face years in prison for human trafficking. All of them told me they hadn't even known what they were doing was illegal, but of course they took the deal. Facing these three women with babies in their arms, I thought about what a difficult and complicated situation this was now for everybody. The women they had intended to serve as surrogates not become new mothers. They all had several children, and they were barely making enough to survive as it was. The parents who had been waiting for these babies and would now probably never meet them. And the babies whose futures had been altered dramatically in just one moment. The Cambodian government believes that this is what they deserve. They had committed a grave human rights violation, taking money in exchange for bearing a child. Or, as the officials describe it, sale of children. I'm Claudia Flores.
And I'm Tom Ginsberg.
And this is Entitled, a podcast about why rights matter and what's the matter with rights.
Today, reproduction, citizenship, and bodily autonomy.
It won't be a surprise to tell you that reproductive rights are some of the most contested around the world.
Scientific advancements and globalization have made that picture even more complicated. Advancements like gestational surrogacy.
Specifically, transnational gestational surrogacy, the process by which mature eggs are collected from ovaries, fertilized by sperm in a lab, transferred to a uterus, someone else's uterus, in a different country, and then you have a baby for money.
So just think about how complicated this situation is from a rights perspective. There's three parties that we're talking about here. First, there's the surrogate. They have a right to reproductive autonomy and decision-making, a right to work. Few would argue that pregnancy isn't labor. A right to basic health care and information about health decisions. Then we have the rights of the child, which is actually the subject of its own international convention, which says the child is entitled to be taken care of in a way that prioritizes their best interests, that they have a right to information about their origins and their parentage, and a right to nationality. And third, we have the rights of the intended parents, the right to found a family, non-discrimination and equality in personal matters such as marriage, parenting, and access to technology. These are all especially important to the LGBTQI community, many of whom rely on surrogacy and other forms of artificial reproductive technology to have children. All of these rights are protected under international human rights treaties ratified by most countries, and some version of them are laid out in many constitutions.
Okay, those are the rights. And then there are the interests. The state has an interest to regulate nationality and citizenship, to prevent exploitation and abuse of its citizens. And then there are the corporate interests, surrogacy agencies. This is big business, not just in Cambodia and other economically disadvantaged countries, but in rich countries like the U.S. And where there's big business, there's always the possibility of abuse for profit.
Yes, and globally, the first several months of the pandemic made things even more difficult because surrogates couldn't hand off the babies to their intended parents. So in August, a surrogacy agency in Ukraine had about 100 babies stranded there, and they made a video to reassure the intended parents, but it didn't go over very well. The image of dozens of babies sitting in this large hotel conference room really irked the public.
And of course, there are the complications that arise whenever parties enter into a long-term contract. In another really famous case in Thailand in 2015, known as the Baby Gammy case, the intended parents from Australia rejected the baby birthed by the surrogate because he was born with Down syndrome. they took his twin sister with them and left the boy with the surrogate mom.
It was the plight of this little boy which forced the Thai government to confront the brazenly commercial nature of what's become a baby trade here.
So you can understand why this raises really serious questions about whether transnational surrogacy can be done in a way that respects rights and protects all parties. Cambodia instituted a ban in 2016. This is what landed the women in jail.
Southeast Asia had been a popular destination for infertile couples, but Cambodia followed the lead of Thailand in outlawing the practice.
The government claimed that all commercial surrogacy is human trafficking, because as they see it, it's the sale of a human. In America, commercial surrogacy is legal in many states and accepted as a practice. But in Cambodia, we have a situation that really does complicate our understanding of what could be understood as a right. Without many of the basic conditions we'd want to see in a surrogacy agreement, an enforceable contract, guaranteed a basic health care, someone to advise the surrogate and ensure that there's informed consent, other employment options, then we really have to ask, is it the right response for governments to ban surrogacy and in turn restrict women's reproductive autonomy? Who gets to decide? What happens more generally when states restrict people's freedom for, quote unquote, their own good?
We decided to go to someone who has some on-the-ground insight.
Good morning, everybody.
This is Kasumi Nakagawa.
I am a professor at the Panyasastra University of Cambodia.
She says that to tell the story in Cambodia, you really need to know three things. One,
sexuality is a taboo topic in Cambodia.
Two, Cambodia suspended international adoption in 2009, in part because many families who were struggling financially were giving up their children in paid adoption arrangements. In other words, as the government saw it, they were selling their children.
And international adoption is still banned because of a huge international criticism that hundreds of thousands of Cambodian children were commercially, internationally adopted by foreigners.
And three, domestic surrogacy in Cambodia is essentially unheard of. If you can't have a baby biologically, you just adopt.
Adoption is so common among Cambodian families, especially rich families, to maintain the family line, because that's tradition they have been carried on for years.
Now, the average annual salary in Cambodia is only about $1,500 US. A quarter of the population is at or below the poverty rate, which prompts an obvious question.
Then what about the women who want to do the surrogacy to help other women and also to support their family for the financial reasons? It is not small amount of money. $3,000 is a huge money and huge profit for Cambodian women who have been exploited in plantation areas, in agriculture, in construction sites. So what about their rights that when they want to do the surrogacy, can we stop them doing that? I'm not completely against the idea of surrogacy. There is a need and there is a demand and there are women who want to do that. The most important thing is to make sure it's safe for every woman. Most of them have very limited education. How can they understand the risk? It may be very, very difficult for those women to give genuine consent to the contract of surrogacy. And I'm not pretty sure that such a guarantee can be maintained in the context of Cambodia.
And Kasumi, besides ensuring informed consent, which is what you're saying, you know, to make sure that the women are educated and that they understand what exactly is involved in the process and what the consequences would be, what other basic conditions do you think would have to exist for surrogacy to be a practice that is protective of human rights?
The surrogate mother should have at least one childbirth before, and surrogate mother should be married and should be healthy, has to pass the certain medical exam. Those are, I think, fundamental, but registration would be very, very important. Tracking who is under the surrogate list and how often do they have a medical checkup. The biggest concern is that if it goes underground, the safety of women will be at a high risk and also the baby.
I think, as you know, there's been a lot of discussion internationally about how to protect children in surrogacy and how to protect women in surrogacy. There are many people who think surrogacy can be a wonderful thing, right? You mentioned even for Cambodians, this idea of helping a woman who can't have a baby, that it's a good thing. But there's been discussion about a transnational agreement to make sure that certain standards are kept up, health standards, legal protections, that agencies are regulated. What is your opinion, knowing the Cambodian context, about whether or not a transnational agreement would be helpful or useful? And do you think that that's a priority in ensuring that children are protected, but that women are also able to exercise their reproductive autonomy?
I think Cambodia's legal system is very weak, and international uniform the system to protect the process in terms of surrogacy would be very beneficial, not only for Cambodia, but for any countries whose legal system is weak. If we are in Cambodia and we listen to the logics about surrogacy, we can see the system of the rich countries, women who are in need of help, is trying to reach to the women in the poor countries and asking for help. And I think this logic needed to be not fixed, but should be changed. Otherwise, it's same as colonization, that the poor South is exploited by the rich North. So international mechanism is essential, but at the same time, such a safeguard or framework or mechanism, whatever it is called, should also treat every woman fairly and also to avoid any exploitation by the rich people to the poor women.
Okay, so Tom, that's a lot to think about.
You know, I guess my view is that exploitation happens everywhere, right? And so what we should be trying to do is try to create the conditions as much as possible for people to make these informed choices rather than using the bad conditions as a way to restrict them.
Absolutely. The justification that the government is providing is one that they provide in other situations where they're restricting women's reproductive rights, such as contraception. Can women really provide informed consent if they're not fully educated about an issue? Perhaps we shouldn't let them make any decisions about their reproductive autonomy. Abortion, for example, is another area in which governments are constantly using the justification that women cannot make that moral choice as reasoning for restricting that right as well. The Cambodian government is essentially failing to provide a health system, failing to provide an education system, legal infrastructure, to make the right to engage in transnational surrogacy a possibility. So what are the implications of using the absence of these conditions as reason to restrict a right?
Yeah, we sometimes call this paternalism, where you step into the shoes of the rights holder or an individual and say, you cannot make this choice because it's not good for you. And of course, in this case, it's, you know, especially about women's reproductive rights. So it's sort of super paternalism.
Yeah, and it's paternalism in a particular context. So the Cambodian government is also putting surrogacy in a very special category. The women that I met in Cambodia were working in garment factories in really exploitative conditions for very little pay. So is that really worse work than the surrogacy labor that they were about to engage in, where they were going to be paid a lot more money for labor in conditions that maybe weren't worse than the garment work they were already doing?
Yeah, right. So I guess what we're asking here is there another way besides denying a woman's right for her own good? Is there another way besides paternalism to handle the situation?
Well, after the break, the former Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights at the United Nations on the broader implications of surrogacy bans on international human rights.
Politics is everywhere, but with a 24/7 polarized news cycle, it can be difficult to cut through the noise.
Not Another Politics Podcast.
Wait. This one is different.
No, I know. That's the name. Not Another Politics Podcast, hosted by us, three political science professors at the University of Chicago.
Why is it Not Another Politics Podcast?
We provide a fresh perspective on the biggest political stories.
Not through opinions and punditry, but through rigorous scholarship, theory, and data analysis.
Join us to discover what political science has to say about the most pressing political issues.
Not Another Politics Podcast.
So to take a step back from transnational surrogacy, we're going to look at the broader context. What does the surrogacy ban in Cambodia tell us about reproductive rights as a whole, And what does it have in common with other conflicts over gender-based rights? What are the forces that can protect these rights in the face of misogyny and paternalism, which exists pretty much everywhere?
Kate Gilmore is the former Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights at the United Nations. She spent her entire career advocating for women's reproductive rights and international human rights around the world. She's a big deal, and she's had a long, illustrious career.
It means I'm very old, actually, Claudia.
Kate works on some of the most harrowing and important issues in the world, but she also laughs more than most people I know. I started by asking her to tell us why she's dedicated her career to women's policy, gender equality, and human rights.
It's not really the case that the UN system has been brave and courageous enough at pushing out the envelope to really extend all human rights to all. At times, it has lagged behind civil society, and therefore jurisprudence has also lagged behind. Therefore, the applications of those norms and standards in the context of policing and courts has lagged way behind. And that lag has caused great sorrow, great suffering, and great injustice to millions around the world. But the second problem, as I see it, is a fusion that many governments have instrumentalized between personal morality, ideas of ethics, and questions of human rights, where our subjective ideas of morality and preference have trumped, if I can still use that verb without cringe, have trumped the more robust standards of human rights. So you see religion, philosophy, and certain political ideologies coming in to take precedence over application of human rights norms and standards. This is particularly dire consequences for women, but actually dire consequences for the body sexual and desirous, with very grave outcomes for LGBTQI people, for transgender women. I really want to highlight because they are amongst those most exposed to extrajudicial executions, arbitrary killings, and so on. But the third problem, I think, is in the area of distilling the implications of human rights norms and standards for great services, great advocacy, great access to information. I feel, as a member of the human rights community, critical of the human rights community for failing to get praxis-oriented enough, for failing to synthesize human rights into other disciplines, and for failing to be bold enough in the actual living out of human rights as opposed to defending it in the stratosphere of norms, principles, and standards. I've talked so long.
That was great.
So I want to bring these ideas into the context of gestational surrogacy. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the kinds of dynamics around women's reproductive rights playing out in the context of gestational surrogacy?
It's extraordinary how the minute the body of the woman comes into question in front of the state and state authorities, all sorts of bizarre thinking, fantasist thinking emerges, and reason, rationality flips out the window, and in comes the priest, in comes the imam, in comes the rabbi to declare for us what should be the foundational basis for determining public policy. And there is utter incoherence, both within the UN system, frankly, and across member states as to how to respond to altruistic versus commercial forms of gestational surrogacy. There are principles to be applied here and answers can be found, but actually we don't even know the size, the rates, the frequency of surrogacy. We just know that it's definitely on the increase because of the greater accessibility to new technologies that make in vitro fertilization options easier to exercise. But at the heart of it, what obscures rationality and coherence in human rights-based public policy here is the misogyny, the bigotry, and frankly, I would almost go so much as the resentment, even hatred of the woman in charge of her own body and in charge of her own choices.
Can you talk a little bit about more about the tendency of governments to focus on protection of women in the context of reproductive rights? Because there are three parties whose rights need to be respected and protected, right, in the context of gestational surrogacy. Yeah. But what's interesting is, you know, there's the woman, there's the child born of surrogacy and the would-be parents. The concerns with transnational surrogacy around the protection of women is that often surrogacy is being conducted in countries where there may not be health systems that can really, you know, provide the sort of support that you want to see, that you can't really enforce contracts. So, for example, in the United States, you know, a surrogate would have a contract with the intended parents, and there's a legal system to ensure that all of the terms are protected. Absolutely. What's interesting here is that the reason those conditions don't exist are because the state hasn't provided them. And so how do you think about the balance of rights in the context where there are other state duties or other rights that haven't been protected? And so this second right can't be enabled. So in the context of surrogacy, the woman is at risk because the health system doesn't exist, right? And that's what requires the protection. The response of states has been to ban. So how do you balance all of those dynamics?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noticing that there are other risks to the surrogate than only the absence of a health system. I mean, there are other coercive dynamics that can enter into a relationship. But you're absolutely right to highlight the health system as being crucial, noticing that IVF brings its own additional risks, that the possibility of multiple births, for example, is much higher with IVF. All these things underscore how important it is to have access to essential health services, recalling also that regardless of whether one retains care for the child born, there's lots of physical and mental consequences potentially for the woman who gave birth, such as postpartum depression. And it raises real questions, as I know you've looked at, Claudia, very powerfully, as to what would be the circumstances in which transnational surrogacy could be considered to be human rights compliant. But it's interesting to see, particularly in Cambodia, how draconian the government response was, rather than enable better, more secure, more affordable, reliable access to healthcare. They shut down surrogacy in a most clumsy and cruel manner, and sought about even prosecuting the woman who was engaging in surrogacy, which is absolutely the opposite of what a human rights response would be to those problems. But the absence of universal access to quality healthcare actually is one of the most important reasons why there has to be transnational regulation of surrogacy, and why absolute prohibition on surrogacy is a nonsense.
And the reason that the Cambodian government gave was that it was human trafficking. What's your sense of this? It's interesting to me to think about the way that these human rights concepts sort of evolve over time and are applied to situations that you wouldn't have anticipated. What do you think about the sort of concern that there's human trafficking and sale of children inherent in the practice of surrogacy?
I can see, for example, the normative system which the UN looks after, struggling to find a coherent message on this. For me, there is no child to be trafficked or sold or commodified until birth occurs. Human rights law at the international level does not recognize the child's existence as separate in any way from the mother until the point of birth. And it's only then that the rights of the child accrue independently and autonomously to that child. And of course, at that point, the child itself should not ever be an object of trafficking, meaning forcible removal and commodification for commercial purposes. Commercial surrogacy is not trafficking of children. It is not commercial selling of children. And to suggest that it is, in my view, is to open the gateway to very dangerous consequences for human rights. There's no question that the issue prior to birth is with the woman who is the surrogate. It's her rights to free, prior, and informed consent without coercion to the act of surrogacy that is prima facie the gravest human rights responsibility, I think, for governments to uphold as she moves into surrogacy. Then it's access to healthcare, then it's decision making along the way, as well as important issues about compensation, including the cost and reward for the labor, literally and figuratively involved.
And it's important to emphasize that the reason we're having this conversation in the first place is because people go to surrogates in places like Cambodia because of the huge global economic inequalities. We're talking about people in the US, for example, paying a surrogate in Cambodia as little as $3,000 compared to paying a surrogate in our own country as much as $125,000. Now, $3,000 in Cambodia is arguably a lot of money. But exploitation seems inevitable given this kind of disparity. How do you take that into account from the human rights perspective? What would be the right amount to pay?
Damn you. I thought I was going to get out of this without having to answer that one. You know, I think in a way, this is the perfect sort of impossible question for human rights to help us answer. What are the borderlines around consent in the context of surrogacy, and then how does one quantify, enumerate the labor-like value of carrying that pregnancy to term and bearing risks unrelentingly for 9 months? How do you factor in that there's no 9 to 5 in pregnancy? It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Once you're on that boat, there's no getting off. And I think there is for the would-be parents a sense, and there should be a sense, of pricelessness on the table here. You know, what is the price of the pricelessness of having a genetically connected child born through the labor of someone else? What must be protected, I think, is this shopping around for cheap sites of surrogacy is clearly both is undignified, improper, and potentially gravely, gravely exploitative. I might add that I think those contracts are not just about the quantity of money, but I think it's also about contingencies. What if the pregnancy fails? What if the would-be parents believe the surrogate did something to injure or impair? We've seen horrendous circumstances where a baby has been born with disability. Now, whatever the details are, you can see the conundrum that can be created if contingencies aren't anticipated and the rights of the surrogate protected in such a manner that they don't become subordinate to the rights of the child and the rights of the would-be parent. As important as
and this has been an issue in the U.S. context where surrogates will enter into these rather complicated contracts. Intended parents want them to only drink green juices or, you know, not leave the house at certain hours of the day. And so all of these issues need to get worked out.
Yeah. But you can see, I mean, the more we talk about it, the more you understand why this should be a matter of public policy and not left to private contract law. And this is exactly the sort of service or option that if we understand that prohibition is absolutely going to have perverse outcomes that we cannot tolerate, then active, proactive regulation in the public domain for this to be a public provided option becomes a very compelling argument in my view. You know, let me just end there by saying, you know, human rights are for the best and for the worst of us. It's not a beauty parade. It's not a point of personal preference. The personal preference is whether or not I would either seek a surrogacy or be a surrogate. Fortunately, that option's long past. But moving on, that's not the human rights question at all. It's nothing to do with what I like or don't like or agree with or don't agree with. It is about a foundation that guarantees dignity to all. And all of us have to move into that space and live within those rules, in my view, for everyone to benefit from the best possible outcomes of public policy.
So, Tom, where does that leave us? What's the matter with reproductive rights in this context? And what is the right international or state response to transnational commercial surrogacy?
Well, it's tricky, right? I mean, this technology challenges so many of our basic understandings of things like parentage, nationality, citizenship, and even property. And as with a lot of new technologies, the market's been relatively unregulated, which tends to lead to exploitation, especially in conditions of extreme poverty, such as exist in many countries. By far, the better approach would be to have like a regulated market in which people get all the information they need, but that in turn requires some government capacity. We Americans like to think of our rights as being freedom from government interference, but this is a case which shows that sometimes we need government in order to facilitate new freedoms.
Right. A ban is a blunt instrument. It means Cambodian women don't even have the ability to make an informed choice. To be a little less diplomatic about it, I think a ban is a lazy response to a complex problem. And what bugs me most about conversations around transnational surrogacy is that they so often ignore that women who labor in struggling economies are always faced with incredibly difficult working conditions and choices. They can't enforce workplace rights. They work for paltry wages. They can't support their families. When you think of surrogacy in this context, it just seems less justifiable to ban this one form of labor that does have the potential for exploitation on these grounds, because many other forms of labor women are doing also have the potential for exploitation. I mentioned at the beginning the research my students and I were conducting for the UN Office of the High Commissioner. What we found on this trip to Cambodia and the other research that we conducted is that what makes surrogacy difficult and dangerous is mostly about the context and not the practice itself. Now, there are no easy solutions, but I will say that we asked the surrogates that we interviewed if they would have done it again had they not been arrested and had they actually been paid. And two of the three that we interviewed said that they would.
That's exactly where a more international approach might help. Regulation for surrogacy agencies, standards and conditions for surrogacy could take the form of some sort of like soft law norms, whereby we set out basic standards that are voluntary, but that surrogacy agencies would sort of adopt and then use to advertise their services as being, you know, high standard providers. And maybe if we insist on involvement from governments where the parents live, as well as those where the surrogates are, we'd do a lot better. You know, that's how we handle transnational labor migration, for example. You know, when people from Bangladesh or the Philippines go and work in the Gulf, it's regulated through bilateral and international treaties. So you could imagine some treaties would work in this area as well.
So you mean treating labor as labor?
We could do worse.
I'm Claudia Flores.
And I'm Tom Ginsberg.
And you've been listening to Entitled, a podcast about why rights matter and what's the matter with rights. On our next and final episode of the season, we expand our concept of rights beyond human beings. What might be the rights of nature? Entitled is a production of the University of Chicago Law School through the University of Chicago Podcast Network. This episode was written by us, produced by Alyssa Eads, and edited by Matt Hodep. Chelsea Carrer, Hannah Abrams, and Simone Gewirth contributed to this episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.